The Crude Life, the most trusted voice in energy.
The Crude Life is now available on Substack. Check it out at www.thecrudelife.substack.com. And now, our exclusive interview.
Levi Perkins, Perkins Electric Innovations.
Thank you very much for joining the programs here today. That's right, programs, plural, because this news story is so hot. We send it out to all kinds of different news organizations, podcasts, social media platforms, etc., etc. Because, folks, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to educate you on the process which is happening, where good old-fashioned get on the great big convoy semi, the American Icon Classic Trucker Semi, is going to have an EV hybrid engine one day. And we're talking with the man who's making it happen, Levi Perkins, who's also working with Kenley Nebaker out of Train ND Northwest through a federal grant through the Department of Commerce to try to make this happen. This is part of our monthly series. As we continue to track the process, we have Levi Perkins with Perkins Electric Innovations on the line with us here, and actually on the Zoom line with us here today. So, good sir, how are you today?
I'm doing great. I appreciate the time today, Jason. I think we've got some exciting just topic matter to talk about, and it'll be good.
So I tried to keep that intro under 30 seconds. I went over a minute, so I apologize to those folks out there that tuned out. Tune back in now, because Levi's back here, so the good stuff's going to happen. Let's talk about an update here, because one of the issues that we had predicted, I guess, in the beginning, so for those folks that want to go to episode number one, where Kenley says that everything should happen just fine unless there's a supply chain issue, and boy, I tell you, Levi, about 2 months ago, we started seeing the news stories come. 6 months ago on this program, we started talking about it when the oil spill happened in Huntington Beach, actually. So it was over a year ago. Yeah, when the oil spill happened in Huntington Beach, a lot of people saw the chinks in the supply chain, or the kinks in the supply chain. I'm not sure if I just offended some people out there with that word from the 80s, so I apologize on that. But well, I'm trying to be very cautious of my language, and as I get free-forming from the hip, sometimes I realize that my upbringing comes out. So talk to me about the supply chain. Where are we at, and what's going on, sir?
So just to put some things in perspective that I think it'd be interesting to talk about today, Jason, a couple of months ago, we took a trip, some of the other guys in the just for the company here, we went down to the Ag Expo in Tulare, California. I thought it'd be interesting to just see that the World Ag Expo, it showcases a lot that have to do with the ag industry, the commercial side of things, and then more so the dairy industry as well. And there was definitely an electric vehicle presence there, and then electrification of machinery. And I've never seen that before at the Ag Expo. There was a little bit last year and nothing the year before that I really felt like maybe one or two booths out of it, you know, a couple hundred booths in these the different barns that they've got or expo areas. But out of, you know, over 1,000 booths, there was maybe one or two a few years ago. And this year there, a couple different manufacturers showcased electric vehicles, but one interesting thing that happened was I actually met with an individual there that happened to work with a really large supplier of batteries here in the United States, and then they worked directly with Bosch and Rexroth. I thought it was great to talk with them. Bosch is a leading manufacturer of a lot of EV components, and especially the controllers and I guess more so they've got a motor line, but controllers. And what was interesting is he actually told me that a lot of their new projects that they have for 2023 to 2024 have been put on hold because they're having a hard time finding batteries. And he asked me, he said, could you share with me some information about suppliers that you have for batteries with this large, you know, like 600 kilowatt hour, 1000 kilowatt hour battery pack that would be on one truck, and if it was in production on several trucks. So there was that, and then I think that was the first time I really felt like, hey, there's really quite a crunch here for the batteries, especially in North America. But then he even talked to me about some of the precious metals and things that they were using, and just the alloys that they have to use for the motors and then controllers especially. So when we got to the DC controllers and some of the inverters, we still have a huge supply chain shortage on, you know, we talk about the cliche word, the chip shortage. That's real. We're still seeing that. We haven't had that kind of wave level out yet.
Can we circle back to the World Egg Expo for just a second?
Yeah.
So the comment that, you know, I have been a journalist for like 30 years, so I kind of can't stop being one. And when you mentioned that there wasn't anything, you know, last year or the year before, then all of a sudden a year later, there's this surge of EV equipment. Obviously, the rise of agriculture and the automation of agriculture and just the whole precision agriculture, integration of drones and EVs and everything, that's kind of been on the forefront for a while. So they are apparently taking their springboard now. And so that part didn't catch me off guard as much as the supply chain issue. Are they picking kind of winners and losers, or picking which industry they think is more? Okay, they are. Okay, so I'm not being crazy, because that's honestly the first journalistic story that came out of that was, okay, do we have to quote unquote feed the world first? So we got to make sure the ag equipment gets taken care of with the rare earth minerals and the mining energy and et cetera. To me, this sounds like some kind of picking of, elimination of free market and yada, yada. I don't want to get political, but there is a little bit of favoritism happening here behind the scenes, it sounds like.
I think that there could be. You know, when we were there, I got to see a few different electric tractors that they had on display. It was good and bad. I think that in certain scenarios they were practical, and they had smaller utility tractors that were electric and for like hobby farms. If Jason, I think you and I both know, you know, I grew up on a farm. When it's farming season, you know, we're right here in Southern Idaho, we're actually about 3 weeks to a month behind on our farming season because we had such a weird winter. And it stayed so long, it never left, that people are in panic mode. Well, when you do that, usually you spend long 24-hour stints, more than, you know, you're spending hours upon hours. You're not working 8-hour shifts. You're spending 20 hours in a tractor seat. So the electric side of that, it's not really feasible, and they know that. But I could tell that there was a lot of emphasis placed on what could we do to see this move into the ag industry more? There was a huge presence for solar there, and that was really interesting.
In what way? In what way was the solar there? Was it there from the irrigation side? Was it there from, you know, feeding the chickens at a certain time, or lighting, or, you know, I guess what way was the solar presence there?
Yeah, maybe all the above. There was a lot of residential solar resellers there. And then there was no manufacturers. It looked like there was a lot of companies reselling equipment. And just between me and you, one other thing that I was really evident is I could tell that I even talked with an individual from Volvo. So Volvo and Mack, they had a truck there that was all electric, which was really neat. It was over $700,000, which it blew my mind. Just knowing what components cost, you could tell they put a lot of R&D in it, and they were trying to recover some of that R&D. I didn't think it was really practical. I talked to the salesman there. I don't know if he knew a whole lot about the truck in all reality. I don't want to throw him under the bus, but, you know, as far as kilowatt hours, it maybe had a 250-mile range or less. And then Mack had a trash removal truck, you know, like a sanitation or trash removal truck there that was electric. And,
Can I ask another question? Yeah. So the two or three examples you just gave, okay, like, are you talking about a sanitation EV truck?
Yes. Yeah.
So do they have one, or do they have, you know, 100 of them? I guess what level of inventory do they have? Because
Yep.
It's great if I have one of them, and then if I get an order for 1,000 of them, but I don't have the supply chain set up to satisfy my orders, well, I'm just setting myself up for a very slow die on the vine type of a thing, unless I can keep getting investors that pump money into our human capital and government grants pumping into our human capital. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So two problems I see with it, and you're right. So right there at the show, I could tell that they were pushing to manufacture those. There's several different companies right now based out of California. So Right Speed is a really big one that I see. That guy's, he's brilliant. He's got, they developed trash trucks a while back that were using, they used a gas turbine engine as a generator so they could have a range extension device and they could charge batteries off of it. And then if they came back to the home dock, they could charge that way. I think it's a good concept, but if you move enough trash trucks, so at one point in time, several California provinces and counties were saying that they wanted to ban, because of trash trucks and like FedEx and UPS or the mail delivery trucks, they wanted to, maybe ban's not the word, they just wanted to push them out to where they would have these route trucks or route vehicles would be all electric. But I think that you and I have already discussed this, Jason. The infrastructure necessary to charge one of these trucks is there, and maybe even 10 in a county. When you start charging 50 and 100 delivery trucks and trash trucks, it would be damaging to the infrastructure. And California's already pushed it really hard with the other EV vehicles. So that's one big problem. The other big thing I see, and this might be for future discussion, do you know that there's not trained technicians for these vehicles yet? I was an instructor. I worked at a junior college for 8 years to train it to individuals to be diesel technicians. That you've got to have people go through training programs. We don't have that yet. I've talked with Kenley kind of extensively about a training program for EV heavy duty class 5 through 8 trucks. We don't have trained or skilled technicians in that field yet. Kenworth, Peterbilt, Freightliner, they've all worked hard to get skilled technicians within dealerships to work on some of their hybrid vehicles and electric class 5 vehicles. It's not there. We're struggling to have trained technicians in just the class 8, ICE engine industry, the conventional trucks. I think that what we'll see is we could have these developed and emerge and they're there and available. But the first time they break down, pretty soon we'll have a bone heap if we don't have technicians there and infrastructure in that regard to maintain them. So definitely some issues there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there really is. So what is your bottom line when it comes to the supply chain? I mean, we're talking about there's might be some, favoritism or picking and choosing of where the rare earth minerals are going. We have just the fact of merging and acquisitions and different still people trying to streamline after COVID, if you will. There's a myriad of examples for issues and that sort of thing. What's kind of the takeaway from the supply chain issue from where you are trying to put together an electric hybrid of a semi-engine and a gas combustion engine and a EV battery type of a system?
Yeah, what we're seeing right now is that so Panasonic's large producer of the lithium iron phosphate batteries and lithium ion batteries. So what they're pushing towards is they want to go towards manufacturers like Tesla. And then some of the other larger manufacturers that are, some of them are utilizing their own battery technology, which is not built in-house. The truth is, Jason, most of it comes from China. They're probably 15 years ahead of us on the electric vehicle spectrum, because they've used EVs for so long in different larger cities in China. They've got a lot of manufacturers there. They pushed that agenda for a lot longer than we have. So the truth is a lot of it's coming out of there. I talked with Eaton and Allison reps both on their e-axles for class 5 through class 8 trucks. And they want to supply to the larger manufacturers in North America, the larger EV truck manufacturers. So like Freightliner, Kenworth, If you look at the specs on all of their hybrid and battery electric trucks, they are all using Eaton axles or Allison axles. Some of Rockwell makes some, but just between me and you, I think a lot of the technology has come from different companies in China, and there's a lot of mixing. Allison at one point said that they're making axles for a company in China, and I almost wondered if it was the other way around, where, you know, they were kind of going back and forth with parts. But it definitely looks like they're favoring a lot of these larger vehicle manufacturers. That's where we're seeing all the batteries and controllers and components going into, because they have high production numbers. So then if you've got smaller companies like myself or other smaller companies there, it's just hard. It's harder to get some of the components unless we source them. You know, they're not sourced domestically, then they've got to be sourced somewhere else and brought in for, and got to be, they've got to be imported in from somewhere else.
Where is somewhere else? I mean, I've read that China owns upward of 90.
Most of the components are coming out of China.
Yeah, 95%. I've read, you know, and I don't know if that's accurate, but you know, I've read upwards of 95% of the rare earth minerals are controlled through China, and they might not even be in China, just through Chinese ownership in companies. Is that correct? I mean, what's the percentage? I guess, do you know?
That could be. Did you see here recently that China put, it's a tariff or tax of sorts. If you buy anything out of China and have it imported to the U.S. that has rare earth, you know, any of the rare earth minerals in it, which would be electric vehicle batteries, is one huge one. I can't remember if it was 12 or 17. It was a pretty big number when you're talking batteries that are $50,000, $60,000 per vehicle. It was like a new tax. It was just them saying, hey, if it leaves China and goes to you, we're going to tax you for it. And it was targeted directly towards the EV industry. There's just no way around it.
Have you looked at hydrogen?
Yeah, we have. So Cummins producing a reciprocating piston hydrogen engine that's really interesting. They've always had different engines that could run. They've had diesel engine bases like the short block, and then you could interchange cylinder heads to run on compressed natural gas, on propane, on diesel. None of them were converted to gasoline, but so now they've got one that they want to have run on hydrogen, and Toyota has a similar kind of platform. And if it was mass production, what do we have for like a hydrogen fueling stations abroad and infrastructure for that to fuel the truck? So there's that thought. But yeah, I think it's very clean. It's extremely clean.
Is that something that you could look at? I mean, is there any sort of advantage to going to hydrogen, or, you know, trying to figure out, I don't know if you can do a EV hydrogen hybrid, if you can do a gas combustion hydrogen hybrid, if you could just figure out a liquid natural gas. I know that there was a big push 10 years ago for, you know, liquid natural gas CNG, LNG. I mean, BNSF, they spent billions converting their thing. So how about some of the other, you know, areas of energy?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we could, you know, here's some topic for discussion on the actual prime mover that we could have run a generator or a range extension device in the vehicle. It could be a reciprocating piston diesel engine. They have some really highly efficient ones in small form, you know, around 3 liters. And then they have even better as you approach the 7, 8, 9 liter range, where you're not a 15 liter truck engine, but you're not a small compact diesel in the 3 liter range. So that's a really viable, good option. We obviously have fueling infrastructure for that. But then another one is we can do a diesel compressed natural gas, diesel propane hybrid of sorts with the engine to run the generator for this hybrid platform or chassis. And that one, they're highly efficient. It reduces oxides of nitrogen to run part compressed natural gas on a diesel engine where you'd fumigate through the intake manifold. I think that that's a brilliant process. It doesn't compromise the integrity of the engine at all to do that. Another really good option that we've had and we've talked about lately is, in all honesty, there's some really highly efficient direct injected gasoline engines now. And if they're turbocharged, they're really efficient.
What does that mean? What does that mean, a direct gas injected engine? How's that different from a regular engine? Excuse my naivete.
Oh, no, that's okay. So in the past, historically we've had gasoline engines, and eventually we just try to control the metering of fuel into the intake side of the engine. So it was always probably done with a carburetor in the beginning and different forms of carburetors and fuel atomization. And then eventually we went to throttle body injection, was one form where it looks like a carburetor, but it's got two small injectors or maybe four injectors inside of a body that would take the place of the carburetor. Well, then eventually we thought, let's experiment with port injection where, if it was an 8-cylinder, each intake runner to each cylinder would have its own injector. So it'd have 8 injectors. That's, that's what it's been the last 20 years is port injection. And then eventually we thought, kind of stealing some technology from the diesel side of it, we could have direct injected gasoline engines where there's an injector injecting highly pressurized gasoline fuel through an injector directly into the head, just like directly into the combustion chamber through the head. So it wouldn't be metered through the intake port or through the intake valve. It'd be just directly injected. And I think it came because we've got some advanced electronics that can control it better. Well, then all of a sudden we just could meter the fuel a lot more precisely, for lack of a better term, just better atomization. And then if you couple a turbocharger on that, now you got these amazing, GM has a 4-cylinder and half ton pickups that gets almost 30 miles to the gallon. It's a very small 4-cylinder, but because it's turbocharged, it feels like a V8, gets really good fuel mileage. That's a really good platform. Excuse me. So that's another kind of avenue to, Kinley and I have spoke about that. I love the idea of the gas turbine engine. They're just so highly inefficient for fuel consumption. They're actually pretty clean. They meet emission standards on the diesel side. If they're burning diesel or jet fuel, they could burn straight diesel. They could burn gas, kerosene. They're the multi-fuel engine. They just consume so much energy because the explosion events are not happening against a piston pushing against a crankshaft. They're just happening against blades, and they're just not as efficient as a reciprocating piston engine in that regard, but very simple. They've got their application for sure, and I wish it was in a generator for us in an EV hybrid, but it just isn't at this point.
I got thinking as I was going through all the different, energies out there, and I thought, boy, we've come a long way from probably where we started with the EV gas combustion engine. Because in the end, we're just talking about, here's a bicycle, enjoy. I mean, because we're trying to, all these supply chain issues and everything along those lines. So how much flexibility do you have when it comes to this project? Because, the Department of Commerce is the one that's kind of funding the research and some of the ideology behind this. So I'm not sure what the fine print is, but I understand the idea is to reduce emissions in the transportation, the trucking industry, basically. The idea is through a hybrid to see if something like that would work. How much flexibility do you guys have with this, I guess?
Quite a bit of flexibility. I think that the end goal initially, and again, I'd let Kinley kind of speak to this, but at some point in time, historically, Kinley and that Trained ND had looked at purchasing an electric truck, and then eventually there was discussion about a hybrid. And between him and I said, what if we have our company develop something that was highly efficient as far as fuel consumption? So that became most of our focus. And so I think the R&D was there. It was, if we have a battery electric truck that's plug-in, we could measure it in kilowatt hours of energy usage, mm-hmm. but because it's a hybrid, we're still always going back to that platform of how many miles per gallon would we, how many miles per gallon of fuel consumption would we have? And there's a lot of latitude there. You know, Kinley and I here recently had spoke just to the tune of what, if we have a, you know, we talked about the smaller 2.8 liter or 3 liter engines powering a generator. We talked about AC and DC generators and their efficiencies there to charge a DC battery. And then we spoke about even having, you know, there's parallel hybrids where you've got a, you know, maybe a 6 or 7 liter engine with a transmission coupled to a front drive axle, you know, that's at the rear, but the front, the leading drive axle, and then have the back drive axle be a electric or e-axle and have it be hybrid in that regard, where you still have a mechanical drivetrain, but you've got motors in the back axle. And then we even spoke about having maybe a 9 liter engine with a belt driven or crank driven, crank assisted motor, where it would just feed power into the 9 liter engine, which wouldn't be sufficient for the 80 or 110,000 pound payload, but it would help it. And we could pull energy out of a battery that was either plugged in at night or just charged through a generator that was on the truck. And so there's a lot of different ways. And again, for lack of a better word, there's a lot of different ways just to kind of to make this happen. And yeah, we've got some latitude on it, and we've got a way that we want to do it. And I think that it'll be good. It's maybe not so proprietary, but it's not been done before. And we're at this point, we're sticking with it. We've had a lot of discussion back and forth about different ways we could do it a year ago, and even recently, again, just revisiting this design. And I think we'll probably stick with our original design and continue to push forward that in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're probably on the right track there, because that definitely is somewhat of the future, if not the transitional future. I know Kenley, this was actually, in his mind, I don't want to speak on his behalf, Kenley Nebaker with Train ND Northwest, but there was such a CDL shortage of drivers out there that this actually was considered possibly one of the solutions to help satisfy the workforce problems and some of the job issues that exist with truckers out there. You know, modernizing the trucking industry, for example, is a way to help with the workforce issues. I don't know if you guys have had a conversation about that, but I'm sure that was part of it too.
It was. Yeah, that's a good point, Jason. And I don't know. I mean, just as another thing to kind of speak to, you know, what's kind of interesting is for a long time, we can see this in a lot of different industries, but human beings are creatures of habit. When we first had if you think about automobiles, and then eventually we would think about some type of version of an automobile to have payload on it, or a bed on the back, or a flat piece of wood that they could put things on. Eventually it became a truck. And then these trucks, you know, the more we towed with them, whether it be directly on the vehicle or even, you know, as we progressed, they built trailers for them. You know, my grandpa Jack even talked about driving a truck from Missouri back in, I don't know when this was, it'd probably be in the 40s or 50s, and saying how rough it was. He's like, it beat you up. You know, you could pee blood at the end of the day from your kidneys being so beat up. There's no suspension on them. They were just, you know, it was a tin box on top of this big rigid frame and really low horsepower, but enough to pull a trailer. They would transport, I don't know if it was tires or what it was, but, so I think we've come a long ways, but because we're creatures of habit, Jason, let's be honest. I mean, we're still putting these huge hunks of metal, these engines up in the front of the truck, and we've got this big, massive heat exchanger, a radiator out there. I love the look of the conventional, like the Peterbilts and Kenworths, the long nose trucks. But at some point in time, and I would pay credit to Tesla over this, there has to be kind of a restructure where we just start to think outside the box. And we have these ideas emerge that are very abstract, but functional. And they're getting the job done and probably doing it in a better way. But we've got to have some supporting structure and things that need to change. I mean, just case in point, Jason, I'll tell you, Do you know that we've used axles on semi-trucks that have a specific number of lug nuts, 10 lug nuts to be specific? We've used those for over 70 years.
What's the point of 10?
I don't know. I think at one point in time they had 5 and then 6 and then 8 and then they went to 10. You know, you see China and Europe, they've had some with 12 and 15. But what I'm saying is, and we use...
I was going to say, why do they not do a derivative of 3? For some reason, it just seems like the derivative of 3 is what works in engineering the best. And then here you say China's doing 12 and 15, and I'm going, well, there you go, folks. All right.
I know. And so you just see, like, the other day I was looking at some, the hub piloted trucks have 33 millimeter lug studs. Well, we've used those for 30 years. So what's happening is, I just think once we've got something that works, manufacturers don't want to deviate from it much. You know, like pickup trucks, Jason, we have an 8-foot bed. Why is that standard? Why are we have a 6-foot bed, 6.5-foot bed? We have a short bed. We got a long bed. Why don't we have 10s, 12s? Yeah. Well, you know, we've got trucks that will go, it's a dually. It has dual rear tires. Well, that was something that happened clear way back in the 30s and 40s, but we just hung on to that. Let's put 2 tires in the back on the same axle. There's a bunch of pieces that just need to be looked at again. And individuals, you've got people that are just true mavericks that really think outside the box, and you get scrutinized for it. But then eventually, if it works and it's changing industry, then you've got to kind of turn the focus towards those things and move that direction. And hopefully that's what's happening. I think it is.
I think so too. What kind of, in summary here, as we kind of look at the clock and wrap up, what's the takeaway from the supply chain that, you know, you'd like people to know that's happening right now from either from an R&D standpoint, an EV vehicle standpoint? You know, you mentioned I wrote down in my notes the agriculture EV machinery just coming out of nowhere. If I also was... taking notes, if I was an entrepreneur, I would say take a look at maybe what the mechanics are going to be doing in the future, and we'll have a conversation in the future about that, because that's worthy of its entire series, which is mechanics are going to be changing in the future. Hardly anybody's talking about that, from diesel mechanics to EV mechanics. That's a whole new wave of training, education, safety, OSHA, all kinds of different stuff. So just from a supply chain standpoint, you know, if you're an average person, if you're an R&D person, if you're somebody, you know, in the government, if you're somebody, you know, whatever, what's the number one, number two thing people should know right now that's happening from your world?
I think the supply chain is, it's getting better, and that's what we've seen, and it's rapidly getting better. So if someone asked me 6 months ago, I'd say, I'm scared. I can't, you know, you can't get a lot of these products. A lot of products are 12, 18, 24 months out. But all of a sudden, and I don't know what the catalyst is, but in the last 2 months, some things rapidly changed. And then I'm seeing kind of the fog clear a little bit. And now we can see some light at the end of the tunnel. And it looks like they've got a lot better as far as like the EV, the electric vehicle components. And especially in terms of batteries, axles, motors, the controllers, those have got a lot better. I don't know about battery electric vehicle manufacturers. I'm not sure as far as a whole platform, but as far as components and building them, it's better. And I think what you said, they're definitely tailoring. A lot of their production was initially pushed towards industries and sectors that would have, that they thought need to have emphasis. So they tailored to them. And that's understandable. I think it's getting better, though, and I'm happy about that.
Well, how do people get in touch with you, or kind of give yourself a plug, if you wouldn't mind, here for at the end? I'm trying to hold a sneeze in right now.
No, that's okay. Yeah, it's Perkins Electric Innovations, and you know, we lately, Jason, we've really pushed towards. We're based out of Southern Idaho, and we've built a lot of different custom vehicles, mostly on the The light duty and medium duty side, but more so now we're focusing on the heavy duty truck industry. And then we're actually looking at a bunch on the ag industry too. And I've even had a lot of people approach me here recently about just sports cars that are electric, drivetrain sports cars, but I like the hybrid approach. So I'll just keep pushing that. I've got a kind of an agenda with keeping things hybrid and continuing to utilize the oil industry that we have because it's viable, and I want to continue to support that. And so just making a bridge between the two. I like the idea of the modern technology and the drivetrain, the simplicity of the electric drivetrain, but I also really support the gas and oil industry, and I think I always will in that regard.